Today is Sunday, January 6th, 2008. My name is Sandy Fahler, and I'm an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today, I am interviewing Dr. Leonard Berkowitz, Vilas Research Professor Emeritus, who retired from the UW-Madison Psychology Department in 1993. Dr. Berkowitz received his PhD from the University of Michigan in 1951 and joined the UW-Madison faculty in 1955. He has also held visiting appointments at Stanford University, the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences, Oxford, Cornell, and Cambridge Universities, and the University of Western Australia. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're going to start this interview by asking you if you would talk about your early life, where and when you were born, talk about your family, your parents, where you went to elementary school, high school, any people that influenced you in your career.
Well, that covers quite a range. I was born in 1926 in New York City. My parents were immigrants who had come from Russia. I guess it must have been somewhere around 1922 or thereabouts. I really don't know the exact date. They did not talk very much about their early years in the United States, or for that matter, their life in Russia. It was something that they seemed to have turned their back on and just didn't talk about it. They talked Yiddish to themselves, but they also didn't care to teach me and my brother Yiddish. So, and this is something that I regret, they didn't even teach us the rituals and traditions of Judaism. So, for example, we did not go through the tradition of lighting candles on Friday night. It's almost as if they had turned their backs on their past, even though they did keep a kosher home. At any rate, I lived in a, I would say, a lower middle class neighborhood in the Bronx. It was virtually all Jewish, with the exception of an Italian family across the street. They were the only non-Jews that I ever knew in those years.
What did your parents do?
My father was what's called a customer peddler. This is a occupation that has, in a way, a long tradition. Barry Goldwater's grandfather was a customer peddler. And what they essentially did was to provide goods and appliances to poor families who did not have sufficient credit to buy things on time from department stores. So what my father and customer peddlers generally did was to go from door to door offering to in the apartment houses in the city. My father worked in most of his customers were in Harlem. Spanish as well as Black Harlem. He went from door to door offering linens, radios, and things like that, which the people could buy from him.
Did he work for himself?
He worked for himself. They congregated, the customer peddlers that my father knew, all had as their headquarters, I think, some kind of store in the area from which they then fanned out.
So like a cooperative, more or less?
It wasn't a cooperative. They worked independently, okay. But they had a common base, so to say. I don't think it was a cooperative. It was not very dangerous. This kind of activity had some dangers. Indeed, my father was mugged, he told me, a few times. And of course, it was also very hard work climbing up the stairs to the apartments at the top floors. Later on, my father accrued sufficient capital so that he and the partner were able to open a dry goods store. But they did maintain this customer peddling for some period of time.
And what about your mother? What did she do?
My mother was just a homemaker. She was a fairly intelligent woman. She was an ace chess player. She did not pass on that talent to me, however. I don't have the talent or the temperament to play chess, but she was an excellent chess player. At any rate, neither my mother or father had any kind of real education in the United States. I think my mother went to night school for several years, maybe at the, I don't know what, at the high school level. My father never did have any kind of formal education in the United States. My father read avidly American newspapers. I still have vivid images of the his bringing home newspapers to read every night. My mother didn't seem to be especially interested. And that was the time when Europe was increasingly in turmoil, when World War II was it was certainly off the horizon, or on the horizon, I should say. Sorry about that. So my father followed the news quite avidly. At any rate, I went to local public school. I was sort of bright, and I think I was number one in my graduating class in eighth grade. I then took an exam and went to Stuyvesant High School in Lower Manhattan, which was a science high school. This was, I don't know when I went there, maybe around 30, I don't remember what year I started, but with World War II in the offing, American entry into World War II in the offing, there really wasn't all that much science taught at the high school at that particular time. There must have been teacher shortages. But it was quite a nice experience being in this high school. This was an all-boys school at that time, and I think that was unfortunate. My understanding is that Stuyvesant is now co-educational. It was also an interesting experience because it required me to travel on the subway for about an hour from where I lived down into Lower Manhattan below 14th Street. I must confess that on a few occasions, my friends and I would not continue our subway journey, but would get off on 42nd Street, Times Square. And Times Square at that time had all kinds of movie theaters that had live music. And I still remember quite fondly listening to Frank Sinatra sing at the Paramount Theater on 42nd Street when he was with, I think, I don't know whether it was Tommy or Jimmy Dorsey. At any rate, those were four pleasant years, even though I didn't engage in much extracurricular activity at the high school. I don't remember if there was much extracurricular activity, but we had to get back on the subway and go back home. So that certainly wasn't an encouragement for staying in the school and engaging in all kinds of outside the school activities. In 1943, I started at NYU.
When did you know that you wanted to go on to higher education?
Oh, I always knew that.
You did.
I always knew.
And that was encouraged by your parents?
My parents indeed encouraged going on to higher education. Like the stereotypical Jewish family, they preferred that I be a doctor. I was never interested in being a doctor. For some strange reason, I still don't know why, I was never especially interested in matters biological. I actually have a stronger interest in the physical sciences than in the biological sciences. But my true love, of course, is the social sciences. And the social sciences always interested me. I was fascinated, even in high school, with the idea of human behavior being predictable, with the idea that there are principles governing human actions, that there are laws that can be discovered describing how people act and why. So that was always of great interest to me, and I always wanted to be in the social sciences, especially in psychology. My parents still preferred that I be a real doctor. And by that time, my father had enough income so that I started at New York University, because the cultural myths of our time and our place suggested that Jews would have a better chance of getting into medical school from NYU, which was at that time very much a second-rate university, but nonetheless a private one, than coming from the City College of New York, which of course was a free public university. So I went to NYU. I must say that my experience at NYU was not at all satisfying. It was, I said before, a second-rate university. Perhaps I should say a third-rate university at that time. Partly, I suppose, because of the shortage of teachers, but also because of the way that university conceived of itself at that time. At any rate, it was a very different university from the way it is now. Now it's a superb university. But at that time, it was not at all good. And I had quickly decided to major in psychology while at NYU, but got a very second-rate education in psychology there. They had two, shall I keep on in
Absolutely.
This vein?
Absolutely.
They had two faculties in the even in their liberal science division, they had two faculties. One faculty that was intended to teach undergraduates, and then a graduate faculty. The undergraduate faculty was really not up to date, at least in psychology. They, in concentrating on teaching, they had no encouragement. I doubt whether they were rewarded for keeping up to date. They certainly weren't rewarded or expected to do any publishing, and one and one consequence is that they did not keep up to date. So that when I started at the University of Michigan for my graduate work, I really did not have an adequate foundation in psychology.
Now, did you realize that while you were at NYU? Did you realize that your education isn't...
No, I really didn't. I was not very sophisticated, educationally speaking, and that showed up in a number of ways. For example, how I got into the University of Michigan. I had something of an applied bent. And thought I would be an industrial psychologist when I graduated from NYU. So I applied to various universities for graduate work, intending to specialize in applied or industrial psychology. At any rate, I was told, and this was really the only kind of advice I ever received with regard to applying to graduate schools. I was told that it would be advisable to take selection examination called the Miller Analogies Test. It was a combination of a test dealing with analogies, reasoning and vocabulary together. At any rate, when I took the test, I was told at the end of the examination that the results would be sent to three universities free of charge. I did not know three universities who required the Miller Analogies Test, but I suddenly remembered that Michigan might be one, so I put down the University of Michigan. And lo and behold, I was accepted there. I was turned down by many other places, but was accepted. I think accepted in large part by chance, because the man at Michigan who was my graduate advisor was an industrial psychologist who wanted a student. So I got into Michigan, but soon after I decided that I was really more interested in social psychology generally than in industrial psychology. So I moved over into studying social psychology. And also by chance, I got a research assistantship on a project studying the functioning of decision-making conferences sponsored by the Office of Naval Research. At that time, there was no National Science Foundation, and the Office of Naval Research was really the only sponsor of social psychological research in the federal government at that time. So I got this research assistantship, in this particular research project. The project never really accomplished very much. In fact, I think the results all in all were very disappointing, but nonetheless I was able to get my doctoral dissertation from using data from that particular research endeavor.
Now, are there faculty? Were there faculty there that today you remember either positively or negatively?
Oh yes, oh yes. I remember a good many of the faculty members positively at that time, and this again is a testimony to the way chance has played such a major role in my life. Michigan at that time, in the years from 1948 when I started to the early 1950s, was really the, what shall I say, the major institution teaching and doing research in social psychology at that time, because of the ambition and drive of the chairman of the psychology department at Michigan. He brought in the country's major social psychologists to Michigan at that particular time. And so some of the really the most important people in social psychology in that era were at Michigan, and I do remember them quite well and quite fondly. Let's see, what else should I say?
Well, you received your PhD in
1951. 51. Now,
that's a short period of time.
That's a short period of time. If the truth be known, it was less an indication of my ability than an indication of the absence of real standards at Michigan.
I see. Still, if you were working with these noted faculty, I mean, you had to be doing a good job.
Well, I don't know that. There was a very bright crew of graduate students at that time, and I don't think I was especially outstanding. I really don't. What was I going to say?
Well, you knew, I want to ask you, in 1951, then, you knew that your future was in teaching or in research at the university level.
Right.
And how did you decide where you wanted to be?
Well, 1951 was a period when the when jobs, academic jobs, were not very available. It was still, this was before the growth, the rapid growth in the 1960s, mm-hmm. when universities really took a real major jump. So my first position was actually doing research for the Air Force. This was at the start of the Korean War. And the Air Force was really very concerned with getting the best out of the air crews and personnel. So I worked for an organization called the Air Force Training and Personnel, whatever laboratory, I don't remember exactly what its name was. I was stationed at Randolph Field, one of the old air bases in San Antonio, Texas. The our particular unit was really social psychological in nature, and we were charged with investigating the morale of the big bomber, of the crews of the big bombers, the B-29s, that were to fly over Korea during the war.
How did you do that?
Well, basically, what we did was to try to investigate those aspects that made for high or low morale in the crews. The air crews at that time were not brimming over with high morale. At least the officers were veterans of World War II who had decided for some reason to stay in the reserves. And even though they were starting their new lives after World War II, they were now called up to fly the B-29s over Korea. So the officers, by and large, of course there's variation, but by and large many of them did not have an especially high morale. At any rate, I was there for 4 years. Here again, the research was not especially successful. We really did not uncover anything of any real importance. I doubt whether the Air Force got its money's worth from my particular unit. In fact, I believe that it was definitely a lost endeavor. Again, showing how chance has played such a major role in my life. By the time 1955 came around, I was desperate to get an academic position. So I wrote to my major professor at Michigan and said, basically, help, get me out of here, please. It just so happened that my letter arrived at about the same time that this man received the query from Wisconsin asking him to recommend somebody for a new social psychology position that had just opened up in the department. And if my letter hadn't arrived at that time, I certainly would have been out of sight and out of mind. So he recommended me. I was interviewed and obtained the position.
Did you have to compete for it?
Oh yeah. In fact, my main competitor was a young man who has proved to be a very major person in American social psychology, a fellow named Bill McGuire. My sense is that McGuire was very bright, but a somewhat different kind of person, did not get along with the senior social psychologist then at Wisconsin.
Uh-oh.
So I think it was largely because of that kind of personality conflict that I was chosen. Not necessarily my own abilities. But at any rate, now what else?
You came in as an assistant professor?
Yeah.
Did they count any of your years with...
They did.
Uh-huh.
They did. Let's see, you might be interested in some of the financial figures.
I am.
By the time I left Texas and the Air Force job, I was what do they call it, a GS-12, and was earning the salary of $5,900 a year, which was a fairly good salary at that time. But when I was hired at Wisconsin, my salary, I think, was something like $5,250. I was given $250 more an academic year than the other assistant professors. $250 more than the others. One of my colleagues, another assistant professor, was really annoyed that my salary was higher than his by $250. And if my memory is right, I think this man didn't speak to me at all during the first semester because of his resentment.
Oh dear.
So again, my experience, as you see, was rewarded.
Absolutely. Well, what was life like as an assistant professor?
Oh, I loved it.
Did you do a lot of teaching?
No, not all. At that time, well, as you know, the different fields within the university are given different, have different expectations. The people in the humanities were expected to teach three courses a semester. But people in the sciences were expected only to teach two courses a semester. Psychology, I think very probably, was regarded as a real science, largely because of the nature of the department, the people in it. They were very highly regarded nationally. Very hard-headed experimental psychologists. And so they had only a two-course load. I might say my understanding is that every once in a while people in physics only taught one course a semester, but my memory is vague along those lines. At any rate, there is certainly that discrimination that continues to today. Salaries are lower in the humanities than in the other fields, and their teaching expectations are greater. So, but one of the fortunate things that happened to me when I started out here was that I was assigned a course that enabled me to teach. It was a course in more or less advanced social psychology where I could teach on any topics that were of interest to me. You know, what's current in social psychology, and I could pick whatever topics that I wanted.
Was that a popular course? I would think so.
Well, there weren't very many graduate students.
Oh.
At that time. It continues today. Relative to the other Big Ten universities, Wisconsin has always had a fairly small faculty and a fairly small graduate enrollment. So, but this was an undergraduate course. I should say that I've forgotten. That was an undergraduate course. But at any rate, one of the topics that I picked to cover was research on aggression. And in preparing to teach this topic, I did a lot of literature search and became particularly fascinated in certain kinds of studies that were studies of aggression that were especially important at that particular time. So I used my lecture notes and my literature search for that course to prepare an application for a research grant from the National Institute of Mental Health, which had recently been started. And to my surprise, that application was successful and I did receive a research grant. Well, that started me on my career studying aggression. It's only because I had that course to teach. And because I had prepared my lecture notes quite well, that I got involved in this.
Talk about how you did the research for that grant. I think I read something about interviewing.
Well, like most of the other members of the psychology department, I did laboratory experiments. Which meant that if one was interested in studying aggression, one had to, let's say, provoke the subjects to become aggressive in studying under what conditions they become more or less aggressive.
So how did you do that?
Well, we started out, one of my early and indeed continuing interests had to do with the effects of frustration on aggression. So we basically frustrated our subjects. For example, we would give them a task to perform, and unknown to the subjects would have the task to actually be insoluble, so they couldn't accomplish their goal. And we studied what they did. Things were also fairly realistic in measuring aggression. In those days, before human subject committees, we could study aggressive reactions in quite, what shall I say, a clear way. The subjects believed after they were frustrated, they were put in the task where they supposedly were supervising the behavior of a partner in the next room, supervising how well this person next door was working on an assigned task. And so they were told what the person's, let's say, ideas were, what his solutions to the task were, and they could evaluate it. The task. The way they evaluated it is they had to give this individual electric shocks. So that if they thought it was a very good performance, if his ideas were very good, they would give this individual one or very few shocks. If they thought the solutions were not good at all, they could give anywhere up to 10 shocks. Of course, there wasn't anybody next door, and they were never really heard, but they believed there was somebody whose ideas they were judging and giving these shocks.
Where did you get the subjects?
Well, like as is true all over the country, maybe even all over the world nowadays, the subjects primarily were students in introductory psychology classes who more or less had to serve as part of their experience, or sometimes they received one or another kind of reward for volunteering.
Didn't you also interview criminals and prisoners and
Well, I did, but that was later.
Oh, that was later.
Yeah.
Okay. So this was your first major research grant then, right?
Yeah, and I continued my research, I don't know, 20 years, 17 years. I had grants, continuing grant. I also had, at that same time, no, a little later, must have been in the late, that was started in the, in must have been around 57, 1957, where I started this aggression research. But in the mid-1960s, or somewhere around there, I don't remember the exact year, I also became interested in helpfulness, the other side of my personality. And so I conducted a series of experiments studying the conditions under which people became more or less helpful to others, worked in behalf of others. And again, we did this in laboratory experiments, where essentially the subject believed that a partner was dependent upon him. And we studied how much effort the individual made in behalf of the other, even though there was supposedly nothing in it for him. That was, all that research was carried out under a grant from the National Science Foundation. And again, that continued, I don't know, 9 years or something like that. I don't remember.
So can you summarize the conclusions of that research?
That helpfulness research?
Yeah, helpfulness first, and then I'd like to hear more on the aggression research,
yeah, okay,
too.
For want of a really more sophisticated analysis, I basically believed that many people in our society think that it is socially proper to aid others who need one's help, that there's a kind of a social norm prescribing that people should give help to those in need. But going beyond that, I was also interested in the conditions under which people were less likely to live up to that ideal, that social ideal. And so in some experiments, we showed that there was that if people were very self-preoccupied, very wrapped up in themselves, very concerned about their own needs, they were less likely to worry. There's nothing especially mysterious about this, but people who were self-preoccupied basically were less interested in working in behalf of others. But somewhat more interestingly, we also saw that there was a kind of resentment of felt pressure to help others. There's a social psychological concept called reactance that's relevant here. If one's freedom of action is limited, there's a kind of resentment that, you know, we resent forces on us to make us do something. And so that also applied to the helpfulness realm. If there's too much of a demand, too much of a felt demand to help others, there can be a kind of reactance, a resentment of that pressure. But at any rate, that particular area studied as research on helplessness was also flourishing at that time, not necessarily because of my own work. In fact, my own work was not particularly important, but there was a lot of interest in the conditions under which people are motivated to help others generally. And so I was one of the early pioneers in that line of study. I must say, so again, you know, the theme of my talk today is how I've benefited from chance factors. So in part here, I was, in a sense, the beneficiary of a widely shared interest in helpfulness. But I must say, I especially benefited from a widespread interest in society and at large, as well as in social psychology, because of my work on aggression. The culture, the country, was very interested in aggression, especially in the mid-1960s, when there were the urban disorders and so forth. And so because of that widespread interest, I did indeed get a lot of national attention at that time. There's nothing better than being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, you have been, you're right. But talk more about your research on aggression.
Okay. Well, while I started out initially with an interest in the relationship between frustration and aggression, my research didn't stick to that topic, and I became interested in a variety of different kinds of questions, including the effects of violent movies. This was before the really flourishing of television. So it was a question of what affects violent movies. There were several governmental commissions, including one led by Estes Kefauver, if you remember the name, on the effects of violent films. So I was called and I testified. I don't think I testified before the Kefauver Commission, but I did testify to some of the other national commissions afterwards. But at any rate, what I did in the laboratory studies, and this was all in the very early 1961, 62, somewhere around there is when I started. What we basically did was show our subjects, one at a time, a scene from a movie. Very often I used a boxing scene from an old movie with Kirk Douglas. Did you ever see Champion?
No.
It was a black and white film in which Kirk Douglas was a champion prize fighter. And the scene we used was about 6 minutes long, showed him getting a very bad beating in a fight, in a prize fight.
Okay.
So the subjects watched that film or a control movie, equally exciting but not particularly violent. One of the films we used was a television documentary about the race between the two Englishmen who were the first to run a mile in less than 4 minutes. And it actually was a surprisingly interesting movie, but non-violent. At any rate, after they saw one or the other of these films, they again had an opportunity to judge another student's performance on a test.
And what did you conclude from that research?
Well, the research findings, not only by me but by many others, has consistently been that seeing a violent movie increases the chances that the viewer will behave aggressively himself. The research has been very consistent in that. But I was interested in more than that yes or no business, but the conditions under which that aggressive reaction becomes more or less likely. For example, if the available target is somehow connected or associated with the violence. For example, I'll give you an example. Just one example. Here was Kirk Douglas getting beat up. And of course, people in those days all knew who Kirk Douglas was. Well, in one series of studies, we introduced the subjects to a partner. This is the guy next door who is going to be judged. Mm-hmm. And it so turned out by a coincidence that in some cases this guy's name was Kirk. And in others that he was given a different name.
That's so interesting.
So the fellow next door was punished more severely if his name was Kirk than if he had another name. He was somehow associated with the victim of the aggression they had just witnessed, and that association made him more likely to be attacked afterwards. Well, that research, that line of research continued. And even I petered out on the helpfulness work and continue that. But one of the things that happened was because I was an active publisher and because the research area was of considerable interest, as I said, nationally as well as in social psychology, I received several job offers from the University of Michigan. They wanted me to come back, and those offers resulted, my department wanted to keep me, and so they convinced the powers that be at the university to give me this violist professorship, which I obtained in 1969. Mm-hmm. Was it? Yeah, 1969.
Are you glad you made the decision to stay?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. For one thing, the violist professorship gave me research funds, so that I really wasn't as dependent on federal research grants for research support.
Yeah, that's very important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as the years went by, I became less and less interested in going through the... My needs were small. I did not do fancy work. And so I didn't, I think I must have stopped, I don't remember, maybe by the late 70s I no longer was applying for research grants. Mm-hmm. By the late 70s, I think.
Any other stories about the aggression research? Can you talk about interviewing prison?
Oh, that was that was not especially important.
Oh.
But for me or for anyone else, but the research did contribute, in a sense, theoretically, to my own, what shall I say, theoretical stance. Ever from the beginning of my work, and I won't go into the whys and wherefores, but from the beginning of my work, I was inclined to think of a lot of aggression as being more or less impulsive in nature. Maybe as a reflection of my own personality. I think that a lot of aggression is planned, is calculated, is deliberate. People say, I'm going to get that son of a bitch, and they go out and do that. But I think that there is also a good deal of aggression that is less thought out, that is more or less uncontrolled or impulsive. It's a kind of an outburst. And so, from the very start, I've been interested in the conditions under which people give a more or less automatic, uncontrolled reaction to others. For example, take the matter of Kirk. There was no reason why these people would want to say, this guy is especially nasty. I mean, for me, it was a kind of an automatic response to a particular kind of stimulus. The person who had special aggression-enhancing qualities, in this case, his name. It might be a Jew, it might be a black, but you sort of explode more, you react more strongly to somebody who has particular qualities, not because you plan it, not because you think you're more offended by the guy, but just because of the stimulus qualities. So, well, with that general orientation, I was interested in people who might perhaps also impulsively react aggressively in real world encounters. And it seemed to me that there could be violent offenders, people who are particularly disposed to be aggressive, who also may respond aggressively in an impulsive, highly expressive way. Mm-hmm. You know, they just lose themselves, they lose their temper and lash out. Mm-hmm. So that's partly in order to study real-world offenders, but also because it was nice to go overseas. By that time, I had connections with people in Oxford and Cambridge and so forth. So I did partly to go overseas to these delightful places. I carried out two studies, one at Oxford and one in Scotland, in which people who were in jail for violent offenses were interviewed. And by and large, in both instances, we saw that there were a number of people with a persistent history of violence who, but these were not real baddies. These were people who got into fights in pubs.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
and had a lot of fights in pubs, and this was a persistent history. They weren't calculated murderers.
Gotcha. Right.
Or necessarily even bank robbers or anything of that sort. They were people who just got into trouble a lot. And so, you know, to sort of typifying this, one of the men I remember said that before he got into a fight in a pub, he would know that there would be one or another of two outcomes. He would know he would either go to jail for beating up the other guy, or would be carried away in an ambulance because he himself was beaten up. Mm-hmm. But but even knowing that, he would say he can't help himself. Mm. He just explodes. And these guys, they don't have the verbal ability to talk their way out of a situation or even to control themselves by thinking of the alternatives that might happen. Mm-hmm. They just focus on the immediate situation and they get carried. They don't control themselves and they don't, verbally tell themselves all that might happen or other things that might be at stake and so forth. Some of these guys had reputations that they thought they had to preserve. They were known as tough guys and they wanted to protect that image of being a tough guy. But still, some of them would say, even so, they sometimes get so carried away that they don't think of their reputation that they have to protect. They just are mad and they lash out. So at any rate, that research just fed into this theoretical orientation I had about the importance of impulsive reactions. And that's really been the theme of a lot of my work on aggression. Even the movie violence work has emphasized how the people, for a short time after seeing a violent film, might react without thought to others around them. Mm-hmm. In an aggressive way, because they get aggressive ideas and then for a short time afterwards, because of those aggressive ideas, they will respond automatically in an aggressive way. So
frightening, because as you said, this was back in the early 60s, and you think today...
That's when I started, yeah.
You think today the how movies and television have become even more violent.
Much more so. There's no comparison.
No
comparison. Well, there's a small group of us who are especially interested in doing experimental work on the sources of these... situational. We're not studying personalities, really.
Mm-hmm.
These social psychologists I'm talking about, we're not studying the personalities of people who are especially prone to aggressive reactions. That's important,
mm-hmm.
let's say. And we do know that violent films are especially effective, you might say, for some people more than others. That's clear. But we're primarily interested in this role of situational factors. A couple of years ago, this whole bunch of us published an article summarizing all of those years of work. As I say, the research is really so consistent. There, of course, are exceptions. If people think that there's a good chance that they're going to be punished, for example, if they misbehaved, then they're less likely to react aggressively. And similarly, the mood of the moment might change after when people come out of a movie theater. They enter other kinds of situations, and those situations might counter.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Of course, if youngsters keep on watching violent movies or violent television repeatedly over the years, they become more disposed to be aggressive. That's clear, too. Now, why did I get into
that? Well, I said it. I just talked about how the movies have changed. And
they become much
violent.
Yeah.
Well, talk about, you said when you first started at Wisconsin, one person didn't talk to you for the first semester, but talk about the culture of the psychology department. And was it easy to get tenure for you?
At that, I was very productive.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like
so. It was easy, but the times certainly helped in other ways, because, as I said, in the universities across the country really started growing by leaps and bounds in the 1960s, and so in those years it was easier to get tenure. It's not that the psych department was indiscriminate. There were people who were let go. Perhaps a higher rate in the psych department here than in other places, because it was a department of high standards. But nonetheless, money was available, universities were growing, and so forth. Something, to digress for a minute, something happened in the late 60s, and My cohort, I do believe, here at Wisconsin, was not anywhere near as worried about obtaining tenure as people who came in the late 60s and afterwards. Those people, maybe for real reasons, maybe for other reasons, seemed to be much more anxious. Maybe also because of the smaller size of the psych department. People used to socialize a lot more. It was a more open, less testing kind of an atmosphere in the good old days.
Now, you said you did teach, but you didn't do a lot of teaching. But did you enjoy working with the graduate students?
Oh, I did.
Yeah, talk about that. How did you find them, or how did they find you, or how does that work? How did it work for you?
Well, here I have to make a confession. I do not think I was a good graduate teacher or supervisor. And I say that comparing myself with one of my colleagues, now dead, unfortunately. This other fellow really worked well with his students. He didn't impose his own ideas on them. He allowed them to flourish, to develop their own thinking, and so forth. By contrast, I was much more focused on my own ideas. And my own very particular interests. So I imposed those thoughts, those ideas, that focus on my students, and really didn't encourage them to flourish on their own as much as I should have. I now, as years have gone by, I've really come to regret how I didn't encourage my students to do their own thinking, to develop in their own ways.
Do you keep in touch with any of them?
Not really. Time has petered by. I still get some Christmas cards.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think, no, I don't. And I really don't. It's been 14 years since I left.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about other activities on the campus? Were you involved with campus governance or
committees? Oh, I was. I was. I was on several committees. I was in the College of Letters for a number of years. I was on, what do they call it? It was a kind of an executive committee of the College of Letters of Science under Dean Cronin. I was that for a couple of years. I was on the executive committee of the campus governance. I forgot even what the...
Oh, the university committee?
The university committee.
Oh, now talk about that. Were there any... Was it a quiet time for you on the university committee?
It was a quiet time. I was chair of the psych department from, 68 to 70. That was a time of troubles.
Yeah, talk about that. I was just going to say, that sounds like it would have been. What happened?
Well, the particular troubles at that time, they were telling, one had to do, not troubles in any real sense, but unrest had to do with a faculty union, and especially with regard to this teaching assistants drive for union recognition, for recognition as a union. So some of my students were involved in that strike to get recognition for the Teaching Assistant Association. That really wasn't... It didn't turn out successfully as far as the students were concerned, and there was no special unrest, but there were nonetheless, I remember some of my students being involved in that TAA strike. More troublesome was the strike around the formation of the Black Studies program. Do you know about that?
A little bit, but why don't you talk about it from your perspective?
I was chair of the psychology department at that time when there was a movement partly led by some Black students but also some white students to establish a Black Studies program. At that time, they really weren't these special studies programs that have since proliferated, and there was some reluctance to set up such a special. It was certainly different from the traditional structure of universities. So on at least one occasion, there was strikes in which students tried to shut down the university in order to pressure the university to establish this Black Studies program. On one particular occasion that I still remember quite clearly, a group of students, white students, all white students, tried to blockade the entrance to the psychology department. On one, I don't think it was at that on that particular occasion, but I do remember when some classes were invaded by a group of protesting students. And I do remember that one of my colleagues who was teaching the course even had a desk thrown at her by these particularly disruptive students. In most of these instances that I recall, they were white students. There weren't very many blacks at all. Mm-hmm. And certainly the most active of them were white students. The university did, in one way or another, accede to the demands, and of course the Black Studies program was established, and there are now quite a few different areas of studies, of all kinds of special studies.
What about the Dow Chemical
riots? Were you affected
by that? And
that was before. I was not involved in that.
Okay.
I was an observer. In 1970, I had just resigned my position as chair of the department in order to go to California to be at this behavioral center.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the very day we left, it was when the Army Math Research Center was exploded. That was across the street from us. The one thing that I also remember is in the mid-70s, was it? There were these demands for greater student participation in the planning of courses, in the nature of courses, all kinds of unrest around student participation in faculty government, and even in the structure of what courses should be taught. That was the era in which faculty members and me as department chair was given non-negotiable demands.
I see. And how did you react to those
non-negotiable demands? I was too reactive.
Oh.
I did not keep my cool. And that, of course, was unfortunate in a variety of ways, especially since the fact that I did not keep my cool was a great reward to the students.
Oh.
They were making an impact. That was very rewarding.
Anything else about university life? Well, yeah, about university life that you'd like to talk about? What do you miss the most?
Well, I really have become quite detached from the university with the passage of time. But also, I'm very much a low-energy person. I never did have a lot of energy, but I have much less nowadays. So I've really become very detached from the university. I can't say that I miss a lot. I miss the contacts with other faculty members. I don't miss committee work, and I don't miss teaching. I still do some writing, and I find that intellectually satisfying. But
so that must mean that you keep up then. What significant developments have occurred in your field in recent years?
Well, With, I think that there has been, it is not widely, what shall I say? It's not universally accepted, but I think there's a growing recognition of the extent to which a lot of human behaviors, well beyond aggression, that are subject to these automatic reactions where people respond in a non-thinking way to the situation before them.
Mm-hmm. This is, why do you think that, based on the fact, on your research and others' research, that it's obvious that violence has this negative effect on people, why hasn't that had an influence on society, a positive influence on society?
It hasn't indeed. There are all sorts of reasons. Well, one reason is because a lot of the research, as I've indicated, is experimental in nature. That is, based on laboratory experiments. And so some people don't believe that they think that the situations that the psychologists have been using are too artificial and so forth to really be generalized. There's also a reluctance to believe that people are influenced in an automatic, non-thoughtful way. And also, people look at their own lives. They know that they have seen a violent movie, they come out of the movie theater, and don't think that they have behaved aggressively. That doesn't happen to me, so it probably doesn't happen at all. Failing to recognize how there are some people who are especially susceptible, but they don't see that happen. Nor do they recognize the ways in which it might occur, how they might be a little nastier than they otherwise would have been. So they don't think it happens to them, so they don't believe it happens to anyone. But there is such a widespread reluctance, for example, that as one case in point, the New York Times won't report any evidence indicating that there's an enhanced likelihood of aggression after violent programs.
Really? Huh.
They don't believe it. The evidence is so consistent that, and as a matter of fact, some of my colleagues have shown that the clearer the research evidence, the less frequently newspapers report stories regarding that evidence. So the New York Times is just one example of many. There's a and also there is the widespread belief, you know, this First Amendment business, how the First, in my view and in the thinking of lots of people, the First Amendment had to do with, let's say, political speech, freedom to offer political and opinion, but it's now been generalized so that the First Amendment now covers the display of violent films. You can't interfere with what people do. They don't allow, it's very inconsistent, exceedingly inconsistent. You can't show a dogfight. Or a rooster fight,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you can show humans killing each other.
Yeah. Good
One thing I do want to remember, I do want to say, when do you want to quit?
Well, we've got plenty of time, so just keep talking.
You started me off.
Good.
As another example of the influence of what you might call situational stimuli. Remember, what happens is that a violent film arouses aggressive tendencies. There's nothing special about the violent film. It's an aggressive stimulus to which there are aggressive responses. What about guns? And so I showed back in 1967, I still remember the date because of other writings that I've done recently, I carried a laboratory experiment showing that if there are guns lying on a table nearby, the subjects were more aggressive than they otherwise would have been. Just the sight of the gun arouses aggressive reactions, aggressive inclinations. Mm-hmm. And now there's been a lot of work duplicating, extending that kind of thing. Initially, there was a lot of resistance. Oh, the NRA was very bothered by this. They've now just disregarded it, and it's basically disregarded this is a fairly reliable phenomenon. It's not guns in and of itself, but the fact that this is a weapon that is used for aggressive purposes. It's that aggressive meaning that enables it to evoke aggressive reactions or aggressive inclinations. Mm-hmm. So for a hunter, a gun is not necessarily thought of as an aggressive object. It's a recreational object. Mm-hmm. And so it has been demonstrated, one of my colleagues showed, that hunters don't become more aggressive when they see a hunting rifle. But if they see an assault rifle, then they become more aggressive. Let me also finally say that to add to my theme of the role of chance, social psychology is a very young field. Of course, there were social psychological studies for a long, long time, dating back at least to the 1900s, but it really began to flourish around 1950 and afterwards. And it started here in the United States. That flourishing started here in the United States. So the Europeans were slow to come into that line of work. And they were very interested in meeting and getting to know American social psychologists because they were late in coming into the scene. And that's one of the reasons why I went to these various universities that you listed, is because I was relatively prominent and the Europeans and others wanted to meet prominent social psychologists as part of their own, what shall I say, education and coming into the picture.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a comment that leads me right to the next question of, would you talk about awards and honors that you've received in your career?
Well, the rewards and honors that were, I guess, a recognition of the, well, partly due to the fact that I was prominent, because I published a lot and had a sort of a specific set of ideas. And also, I think I definitely benefited from the fact that there was widespread interest nationally as well as in the field,
mm-hmm.
In the topic of aggression. I'm not sure that there would have been anywhere near the same amount of recognition these days, because aggression is not an especially important topic in social psychology these days.
It isn't?
It isn't.
It should be.
No.
Huh. Well, no, I was just pulling out a piece of paper here because you've been on editorial boards of several social psychological journals, served as chair of the publication board of the American Psychological Association, president of the American Psychological Association's Division of Personality and Social Psychology, mm-hmm. and the International Society for Research on Aggression, given distinguished scientist awards by the American Psychological Association, mm-hmm. and the Society for Experimental Psychology, and was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Well, I wanted to make sure if you didn't get those on tape that I would.
Well, again, I really have to be realistic and recognize the extent to which much of that, I wouldn't say all, but much of that comes from being in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people are glad that you were at the right place at the right time. Let's end this by, you've been retired now for 15 years.
14.
14 years.
14 and a half.
14 and a half years. So what do you do for fun and excitement and relaxation?
Well, Norm and I travel a lot.
But
I'm running out of steam, so I have to do less traveling. I have a heart condition that slows me down. Besides traveling, I still do things like reviewing journal manuscripts that are submitted for publication to various journals. I have written things like an encyclopedia articles and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of dabble a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And talk about your family today. Do you have grandchildren?
Oh, yes. I have two daughters, both of whom who went to Stanford as undergraduates. They're bright people, but they also benefited from the fact that at the time they went to Stanford, I had a textbook that sold well enough so that I could afford the tuition.
I see.
One has become a lawyer and is now a lawyer for the State University of New York in Albany. Her younger sister was always involved in urban planning, but primarily for banks, and has been involved in sort of commercial loans and the like for banks. Both my daughters fortunately live in the Albany, New York area. So it's easy to go visit them.
Mm-hmm.
They have five grandchildren. I have five grandchildren.
Uh-huh.
They have five children, together, two and three. And two of them or three of them have either completed their undergraduate work or involved in graduate work. One young man is now studying to be, hopefully, a professor of English. One is planning to be a doctor, and another wants to be involved in ecology. So the five grandchildren are all really very nice people and quite smart. The youngest is about 14 or 15 years of age and is really quite smart himself, but with a real bent towards history. It's remarkable how much history he knows. I must say that I'm quite happy with the family situation. Certainly very content with the situation. And as I've said to Norm on a good many occasions, I'm very pleased that the grandchildren have grown old enough so that they can talk like human beings, like grown-ups themselves.
And listen, and talk and listen.
They certainly have their own developed ideas. They're very nice grown-ups.
Well, I've come to the end of my questions, but I don't want to turn the tape recorder off if there's more that we should get on there, other stories about your university life.
Well, I never did talk about my first wife.
Well, you talk about whatever you want. This is your...
Well, this was really an unhappy phase and sort of relevant to your own situation in a way. My first wife came down with breast cancer in 1957 and had a recurrence in 1969. The University of Wisconsin at that time did not have good oncology care. It really was second, if not third rate, and that has now drastically changed. Mm-hmm. It's, the university hospital is very good, but at that time she did not have what I think is up-to-date care. But that's not the reason she died, of course. When she had the recurrence in 69, the cancer really had spread all over her body. But at any rate, that was a minor reason, definitely a secondary or tertiary reason why I didn't go to Michigan, but she had a recurrence at the time I had the offer in 1969. To go to Michigan, and I just didn't want to cope with her situation as well as the business of getting started in a new place.
Mm-hmm. Well, my next interview, of course, is with Norma Berkowitz.
Right.
When did you marry?
In 1975.
Anything else? Because
well,
I know I'll hear something about that from her.
Okay. Norma was a friend of my first wife. And that's how I had met her.
Very nice. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All righty.